Thank you for tuning in to episode 119 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm or download us after broadcast using iTunes or another podcast program. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing Zeno Live at 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. And remember, that is an American phone number, so you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. You can send donations through PayPal to my email address, david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization that you're a member of, on science, on medicine, viruses, democracy, or social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. And thank you to somebody who calls himself Fakeologist for your donation. The last couple of shows have been really long, so I haven't had time to go through the feedback, but my mailbag is actually pretty full. Mary via email wrote, "I was so pleased to stumble upon your podcast of April 12, 2016, the interview with Stefan Lanka. Thank you for your good work. I've been very interested in Stefan's work for years and have also been very interested in German New Medicine. I've even purchased the reference materials to try to understand it, but it is very difficult and complicated for me. You mentioned at the end of the interview having another talk with Stefan. I certainly hope that happens. I've searched quite a bit online for writings by him or interviews in English, and I have been unsuccessful. Again, thanks you so much for your efforts. You are doing very important work, and the rest of us get to benefit from it." And I did send her links to two articles by Stefan Lanka. It's true that there's not very much by him in English. In fact, when I interviewed him, I was surprised at how good his English was. I had assumed from the lack of communication that his English wasn't so great, but it is actually very good. Peter, by email, wrote, "I just want to let you know that once again it was a great pleasure to listen to you on your program this evening with Dr. Wallach. I do take supplements, but I avoid MDs and pharmaceuticals like the plague that they are." Peter also informed me that he'd written that email from a yacht somewhere off the coast of Mexico, so that made me very jealous. Bill, by email, wrote, "That was a very entertaining interview with Dr. Wallach. I realized it may have been frustrating for you, but you handled yourself well. Yes, we have to take everything with a grain of salt, even our dog food. Ha ha." Barbara, via Facebook, wrote, "Dr. Wallach's a fast-talking, brilliant doctor. The fast-talking part persuaded me that he was, quote, the one, but that was before I listened to him in situ, that is, in a real interview in which an equally knowledgeable scientist, you, questioned some of his assertions. Anyone who refuses to disclose basic information, for example, when asked the name of the single mineral correlated with diabetes, he refused to say. That was a total red flag. Many of us every day are swayed by charismatic fast talkers and fall prey to their simplistic solutions. David, thank you for the interview. Plus, when he realized that you weren't buying his obnoxious delivery style, he hastily needed to go because he needed to attend to the 16 calls waiting for his attention. As gifted as Dr. Wallach is, he's arrogant and a total turnoff. Yes, I'm throwing the baby out with the bathwater." A lot of people had a lot to say about Dr. Wallach. Ray, via email, said, "Wallach certainly has a unique background with all his veterinary experience. It was an interesting show, despite his being so annoyingly secretive about the specific nutrients. I was expecting the whole show to be a plug for his supplement, but when I went to his website, drjwallach.com, all I saw was books, no supplements. Somehow I stumbled across a link that took me to majesticearth-minerals.com, where he sells his supplements. If you click on two of the four featured products, you will see supplement facts, which lists most of the ingredients in them. So there was no need for him to be so secretive, since most of the ingredients are listed. And then he provided what he calls a scathing indictment of him at a website called skeptic.com/wallach.html. He went to that site, and curious about what the site says about Gary Null, who founded PRN.FM, on which this show runs, I put his name in the search box. Nothing much about him alone, but in one article, it attacks all the well-known leaders of the alternative health industry, which includes Joseph Mercola, Mike Adams, Gary Null, mainly regarding cancer and other treatments. Of course, since about 500,000 die each year from approved treatments, that doesn't speak well for the cut, burn, poison approach either. It was estimated in a 1998 paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association that 106,000 people every year are killed in American hospitals by properly prescribed medications. If you consider people who are prescribed medications outside of a hospital, say mental institutions, over-the-counter, prescribed by their doctor, nursing homes, things like that, and if you include not properly prescribed medications, in other words, somebody's given the wrong drug, they're given the wrong dose, etc., and if you include surgical errors, hospital-acquired infections, and many, many other things that can happen to you in a hospital or other medical setting, some people, I think Gary Null, estimated that it was approximately 1 million people a year are killed in America by the modern medical system, which would make medicine the leading cause of death. So it does seem extremely ironic when they attack homeopaths and naturopaths and osteopaths and chiropractors, because maybe occasionally somebody dies while having their neck adjusted by a chiropractor, or somebody's cancer continues to grow even though they went to a naturopath and shunned chemotherapy. But when somebody dies by following the rules, by taking chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation, and they die, they died a hero. And of course, the doctors who treated them are also considered heroes, even though it's quite possible they actually hastened their death. In case you haven't noticed, it's election time in the United States. I'm no big fan of Donald Trump, I'll get to Hillary later, but he's quite right to say that the election is rigged. It's not rigged because dead people and illegal immigrants are voting. There are so close to zero cases of that it could not possibly have an effect. There is no large-scale voter fraud. However, the system is rigged because the American people don't vote for presidential candidates. They vote for delegates with complex rules that make it easy to manipulate the system. Yes, Hillary, I'm talking about you now. Americans don't vote for a president, they vote for the Electoral College, which has Byzantine rules. But because it excludes the votes of all but the two establishment parties in most years, true chaos has rarely erupted. But if a third party wins even one state this year, which is possible, America could end up with a president who wasn't even on the ballot. Congress would select the president and the Senate the vice president. What amazes me is how people love to learn the complex and rarely used arcane rules rather than calling for the removal of this archaic and undemocratic system that screams, "We don't trust the average voter." Trump is correct that the election is rigged because of voting machines, which can be easily tampered with. Newsweek magazine, for example, said on September 3rd, before progressives suddenly changed their minds, "Over the last decade or so, it has been conclusively demonstrated that at least some models of electronic voting machines are vulnerable to hacking by people with the skills of graduate students." They referenced a Politico article from August of this year. Graduate students in political science, pardon me, in computer science. No one knows how secure the other machines are because many vendors have asserted their intellectual property rights to prevent the security of their machines from being examined by independent parties. If hacked, an electronic voting machine cannot be trusted to count votes accurately. In an election conducted with paper ballots, the ballots themselves can be recounted. But with many electronic voting machines, there's no record of the votes cast, other than the digital information contained in the machine itself. The idea of recounting electronically cast votes is therefore meaningless. The election is rigged because of ID and other rules that prevent millions of legitimate voters from exercising their rights. Many states, especially in the South, have used their unfounded claims of dead people and illegal immigrants voting to pass rigid ID laws. Every well-off person has easy access to ID, such as a driver's license, but it's not true of the poor. Just today, as reported by Slate magazine, a judge in Florida overturned a signature law in that state, a signature law, where votes could be thrown out if a poll worker feels that the signature on a mail-in ballot doesn't match what's on file. The workers are not trained to do this. There's no evidence that they're able to distinguish legitimate from non-legitimate signatures. The state of Florida couldn't show that mail-in fraud was a measurable problem, and there was no recourse if your vote was thrown out. You would not even be notified. Luckily, the judge tossed out the law. The system is rigged because voters don't get to hear third parties at the debates because the two establishment parties don't want to risk a third-party candidate becoming more popular. And they own the debate commission, the two major parties. And it's rigged because the states control federal elections, and the Federal Election Commission, one of the few things that the federal government controls, is designed to fail with three Democrats and three Republicans, and a majority needed to take any action. There was excitement recently reported by The Intercept at the end of September because shock, amazement, awe, the Federal Election Commission just might take an action. They were shamed into this because of the ease with which foreigners can donate big money to American candidates. It should be illegal, but there are so many easy ways around it. Ellen Weintraub, one of the FEC's Democratic members, said, "I was pretty pleased to see that the GOP commissioners received my specifics pretty warmly. Even if you don't believe the entire system needs reform, it's hard to argue that, for example, it would be okay for U.S. corporations totally owned by foreign governments to make unlimited expenditures in U.S. elections." The Republicans were surprisingly conciliatory. Matthew Peterson, one of the Republican members, said he would noodle through some of these proposals a little bit more to see if there might be areas of agreement. That's promising, but it sure leaves a lot of wiggle room. But how exciting it would be if the Federal Election Commission might do a little bit of its job, a job that is only a tiny fraction of the overall federal election process that, as I said earlier, is controlled by the states, all with different rules and regulations. The elections are rigged because without action from the Federal Election Commission, rich people and organizations can easily buy politicians because they can throw almost unlimited money at the elections. And it's rigged because people can be removed from electors lists and will only find out when it's too late. What I found very interesting is how the so-called progressives, and even a lot of Republicans who don't like Trump, are criticizing his claims so heavily. And it's true that, as I said, his type of fraud may not be happening, but the elections still are rigged. And I think Trump knows that it's not just people voting twice that is the problem. At the same time, progressives like Greg Palast are screaming to the rooftop that the system is rigged, for example, in his new documentary, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. There was a lot of attention given to recent reports that foreign agents could hack American elections, but I think the insider threat is much more serious. But now everyone's assuring himself that all the problems of the past, the hanging chads of 2000, for example, are gone. I don't think so. Maybe as a Canadian, I've got no right to point this out, but America is the leader of the free world. So all of us suffer under American foreign policies that foment terrorism because of the war on drugs that has been imposed on weak-kneed leaders of friendly countries that have to maintain good relationships with America. Because of the belief, now pretty shattered, that we just need to be tough on crime and crime will disappear, that has led to rising rates of incarceration all around the world. I think the biggest problem is that elections have become a team sport. Newsweek again. The political stability of the United States over the past 240 years is due in large part to the willingness of election losers to concede victory to election winners. To be sure, close elections like Bush-Gore in 2000 have resulted in disputes about who actually won, but in the end, courts and legislatures have found ways to declare victors, and the losers have accepted those declarations. You see, it's just a game, and when the final whistle blows and you've been cheated out of a win, you're a good team player and you just suck it up. Democrats use this knowingly. Howard Dean was anti-war. He came close but lost, and then he sucked it up and supported the nominee. The same for Bernie Sanders. activate the voter base, get people excited with the Democratic Party finally doing something progressive. And then when the progressive, like Bernie Sanders, loses, tell him that he has to tell people to vote for the non-progressive who won, like Hillary. Say what you want about Trump, but somehow he navigated past all the stumbling blocks and outmaneuvered everyone. Clearly, the establishment didn't want him to win, and I still can't see the fancy footwork that got him to where he is. There is a lot of attention paid to Trump's abuse of women. I know that some people believe Trump that, A, when he said he was sexually assaulting women, he was just locker room joking to another guy, and B, every single one of his accusers is lying, even those who had initiated lawsuits against him prior to the Hollywood Access tape surfacing. I don't believe him. But people have forgotten, a lot of people anyway, that Bill Clinton is basically the same when it comes to women. I'm not sure a consensual affair, e.g. Monica Lewinsky, really was the problem it was made out to be, but both men have forced themselves on women. Consider Paula Jones that I discussed in an earlier episode. Bill Clinton's multi-$100,000 settlement tells us all we need to know, that he really did expose himself to her and demand sex, and Hillary participated in the cover-up. It's also true that Hillary's first court case was getting a man who'd raped a 12-year-old girl off with a slap on the wrist by excluding evidence from the trial, evidence that would have put the man in jail for about 30 years. But an accusation against Hillary is that she says one thing to the bankers and another to the public. And now we know it's true. She has said it herself. Despite the catastrophe of 2008, when the banks almost took down the economy, she soft-pedaled in her speeches to those same banks. Why did the banks pay so much for the speeches? Can her words really have been so amazing to be worth six figures? Or the words of Bill? No, clearly the corporations and the companies that paid hundreds of thousands for speeches and millions into the Clinton Foundation knew that this was how you buy influence. Influence peddling that's legal, semi-transparent, and nobody will do anything about it. I don't want to minimize sexual assault on women, but there are only so many women that a President Trump can fondle or assault in a four-year term, whereas there are millions of people who could be killed by President Hillary Clinton if she starts just one more war. On the other hand, maybe Trump will prove to be a worse warmonger as well as a sexual assaulter. America, I feel your pain. I also cannot wait for this all to be over. Now let's warm up to a lighter subject, climate change. There's an article in Think Progress. The second largest city in the US is on the verge of being 100% renewable. That city is Los Angeles, and that headline is pretty amazing. I would love to think that Los Angeles could get close to powering the entire city on renewable energy, but what does it really mean in practice? Quote, the city council is going to consider a motion this month that would direct the municipal utility to determine how to move the city to 100% renewable energy. Somehow, the headline of this article doesn't seem to match the reality. That's not being on the verge of being 100% renewable. That's about being on the verge of talking about how sometime in the future you could get maybe close to being mostly renewable. They talk about how the city recently spent $57 million to replace its traditional streetlights with LED bulbs. That saved the city $9 million a year in electricity costs, and that was equivalent to almost 9,000 homes worth of electricity. No question, that's a good move, but what are they doing about replacing the freeways with public transit? I don't think that's going to happen. The Los Angeles public transit system is better than it used to be. They do have a little bit of a subway, but it's nowhere near enough to displace a significant amount of the traffic on the highways. They also announced 100 new electric vehicles have been added to the Los Angeles Police Department's fleet, and 104 new charging stations open to everyone. And I always wonder whether those are free sources of electric power. I really thought about the electric car because of other reasons. I'm not really a big fan, and I did some back of the envelope calculations. I found that in the United States, people drive about 2.5 trillion miles a year, which is about 4 trillion kilometers a year. I discovered that the electricity used by an average electric car is about 150 watt hours a kilometer. Anyway, I did a little bit of math. It wasn't really that difficult, and I came up, compared it to what the American electrical production is, and I calculated that if every car in America went electric, it would be equivalent to about 16% of the current electrical production. And currently, alternative power is about 7%. So you'd have to triple the amount of alternative power that's being produced without any reduction in the amount of coal or natural gas that's being burned. And Los Angeles is not that far away. It gets 20% of its electricity from renewable energy sources. So that's better than the American average. It's over double. Nuclear and hydro are about 11%. But coal is still 40%. And natural gas is 22%. So after all of this time, we're making progress. But how you get from 20% renewable to 80 or 90% renewable, plus converting all the gasoline-burning vehicles to electrical vehicles, which would require you to produce much more electricity than you're currently producing, how you do all this within the next century seems a huge challenge to me. And so let's go back again to the headline of the article. The second largest city in the U.S. is on the verge of being 100% renewable. Unfortunately, it's a long way from that. And although I'm a skeptic on climate change, I do think we need to get off fossil fuels. We just can't wish ourselves there. We need to make progress, but passing a motion to talk about how you're going to get there when avoiding some of the really big issues, which in Los Angeles is the automobile. And even if Los Angeles went 100% renewable, they're only talking about electricity. They're not talking about the energy that's being burned in gasoline and vehicles. So if you don't address the car, then any progress in Los Angeles is going to be illusory. Let's go through some of the articles on vaccination I have recently discovered. Dr. Brownstein, a holistic doctor, reported at the end of last year, at the end of 2015, that he saw a notice from a camp called Tamarack, which put out an edict, quote, "No child, camper, staff, artist in residence, volunteer, doctor, nurse, or family member will be allowed to come to camp without documentation of complete immunization according to our policy." And that policy includes the vaccinations, DTaP or equivalents, IPV, HIV, PCV13, rotavirus, hepatitis B, hepatitis A is only strongly recommended, not mandatory, MMR, or serological evidence of immunity, varicella, that's chickenpox, Menactra, and flu vaccine is also strongly recommended. They use the Jewish term, and I apologize for my pronunciation, Pikwach Nefesh, which means saving a life. Dr. Brownstein remarks, "It's interesting they'd use this term. I'd be happy to introduce the powers that be at the camp to parents, children, and other patients of mine who have been injured by vaccines. Maybe these people would have a different take on this draconian policy. Perhaps the camp is unaware that over $3 billion has been awarded by the federal government to children and adults injured by vaccines." And I should add, that's despite the fact that most requests for compensation have been denied. "Maybe Camp Tamarack can assure all those who will have to be fully vaccinated to attend camp that it is safe to inject numerous doses of neurotoxins like mercury, aluminum, formaldehyde into any living being. As far as I am aware, there are zero safety studies on injecting a neurotoxin into a living being. I'd like to see where Jewish law says it's safe to inject one into a baby or any other living being. Maybe Camp Tamarack should take notice that there is a whistleblower at the CDC, a senior scientist who authored research papers on childhood vaccinations, who stated that the CDC has hidden and altered data that has confirmed a link with the MMR vaccine to autism. Or perhaps they could provide an explanation of why another whistleblower scientist who worked at Merck, which manufactures the MMR vaccine, has filed a federal lawsuit saying that the mumps data used to justify the MMR vaccine was falsified by Merck. In a Tamarack letter, they state, while parents may choose to defer the vaccination of their children, for the camps, this is not an issue of individual rights and choice, but an issue of public health and policy. One thing that Dr. Brownstein didn't mention is that when a mandate like this is put out, there's the possibility that some parents who suddenly realize that their child is 6 or 7 vaccines short of what they need to go to camp and desperately wants their child to get out of their hair for the summer will take them to the doctor and have a huge dose of vaccinations given within a short period of time. And that is much more dangerous than giving the vaccines over a lengthy period of time. And what can happen when things go wrong? Well, there was a case in England, I believe in January of this year, reported in in the Sun newspaper in England. Horror unfolded at a secondary school after paramedics were called out to treat up to 15 pupils who collapsed after having vaccinations. Between 10 and 15 year 10 students keeled over after having a meningitis jab at Northampton School for Boys yesterday. One boy was taken to emergency as a precaution. One parent whose son just saw the drama unfold told how children were seen, quote, on their backs on the floor with their legs up on chairs. The National Health Service, this is not just a rumor, the Sun is maybe not always considered the best newspaper in England, but they actually have a copy of a letter from Northamptonshire Healthcare, National Health Service, NHS Foundation Trust. Please be advised that the immunization session your child attended today was suspended due to unforeseen circumstances. Some of the vaccinated children have become unwell shortly after a vaccination. An admission that vaccines can cause adverse effects. It doesn't sound like that was too terrible, a child fainting. Maybe afterwards they were all okay. But here on the website wearechange.org is the story of a baby in California that died after receiving 8 simultaneous vaccinations. According to Crystal Downing, the mother, her son Matthew had been given DTaP, IPV, which is inactivated polio vaccine, HIB, hepatitis B, hepatitis A, in 3 shots, 1 in the right arm and 2 in the left leg, just a day before his sudden death. He became irritable and cried a lot the day after receiving the 8 vaccine injections. His mother thought this was normal behavior following vaccinations. The Downings thought their child would get better after receiving the 8, only to find his lifeless body the next day. They tried their best to revive him. They called 911 and rushed him to Colorado River Medical Center in Needles, California, where he was swiftly pronounced dead. As is the case with most vaccine-associated infant death, the cause was ruled sudden infant death syndrome, or cot death or crib death. Quote, the sudden unexplained death of a child less than 1 year of age. SIDS usually occurs during sleep, and no other investigations are conducted on the cause of death. How convenient. Parents are often told just to accept the baby's death as a random event, even after their infant was injected with multiple vaccines. Although an autopsy was conducted on Matthew's body, even after more than a year, the results are still undisclosed. Worse, his parents were never allowed to see the body of their son before it was cremated. All they got was their son's ashes. Now they're aware that aside from giving their son an extra hepatitis B vaccine dose, doctors had also given the baby a vaccine not approved for his age, 2 fatal states which could have saved Matthew's life had they only been prevented. But there are other cases where children have died after vaccinations that were completely appropriate if a large number are given all at the same time. Appropriate, I mean, by the standards of the CDC or other organizations like that. Another report is a report released early in 2016, January 2016, by Emerging Infectious Diseases, which is a journal put out by the Centers for Disease Control, have tracked a whooping cough outbreak all the way back to 2013. More than two dozen Florida preschoolers were diagnosed with the illness. Included are two staff members and 11 other family members. Almost all the children in the preschool were listed as vaccinated for pertussis. And why is it that these stories of vaccine damage go untold in the mainstream media or rejected? Well, part of it is conflicts of interest. The World Health Organization, for example, was reviewing influenza vaccines, and they had Professor Ann Kelso from WHO Melbourne as part of the committee. But it turns out that she has financial conflicts with vaccine manufacturers. So instead of removing her from the committee, they just downgraded her to an advisor, and they explicitly said that Professor Kelso, quote, should continue to serve as an advisor. And it then states she did participate in the consultation as an advisor. Well, a persuasive advisor could be just as good as actually having a vote. And this is the type of conflict of interest that is quite normal in the vaccine industry. I might have mentioned this earlier, but in Japan, there is a court case with 12 plaintiffs with serious damage that occurred in young women following HPV vaccination. The court case is against GlaxoSmithKline that makes Cervarix and Merck that makes Gardasil. The American College of Pediatricians has also has sounded the alarm on HPV vaccination, although they claim that they're still in favor of vaccination. Scott Field, MD, writing on behalf of the organization, stated, one, long-term ovarian function was not assessed in either the original rat safety studies or in the human HPV vaccine trials. Two, most primary care physicians are probably unaware of a possible association between HPV vaccination and premature ovarian failure. And I should point out that premature ovarian failure means that a young woman and women or girls are vaccinated in their teens before they're likely to have children. It means they probably cannot have children in their life. Doctors may not consider reporting premature ovarian failure cases or prolonged amenorrhea, which is the missing of menstrual periods, to the vaccine adverse events reporting system. Three, potential mechanisms of action have been postulated based on autoimmune associations with the aluminum adjuvant used and previously documented ovarian toxicity in rats from another component of the vaccine, polysorbate 80. Four, since licensure of Gardasil in 2006, there have been about 213 VAERS reports, which are American Adverse Vaccine Reaction reports, involving amenorrhea, premature ovarian failure, or premature menopause, 88% of which have been associated with Gardasil. Cervarix, which was only licensed in 2009, accounted for 4.7% of those reports, 8.5% between 2010 and 2015. In the period of 1990 to 2006, no cases of premature ovarian failure or premature menopause and only 32 cases of amenorrhea were reported to the VAERS database. In January of this year, Dr. Singhang Lee, an MD, sent an open letter of complaint to the Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Margaret Chan, charging members of the GACVS, the CDC, the Japanese Ministry of Health, Labor and Welfare, and others with the manipulation of data and suppression of science in order to maintain the illusion of HPV vaccine safety in the face of valid contradictory evidence. In her letter, she states, a series of emails recently uncovered via a Freedom of Information request submitted in New Zealand revealed evidence that Dr. Robert Pless, the chairperson of the Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety, which is GACVS, Dr. Koji of the Ministry of Health of Japan, Dr. Wharton of the CDC, Dr. Petusis Harris of Auckland University, New Zealand, and others, including WHO officials, may have been actively involved in a scheme to deliberately mislead the Japanese expert inquiry on human papillomavirus vaccine safety before, during, and after the February 2014 public hearing in Tokyo. Natural News just reported that cases of a rare polio-like disease that typically affects children are on the rise in the United States, and no one knows exactly why. Between January and August of this year, health officials reported 50 new cases of acute flaccid myelitis, AFM, an illness that can cause paralysis, with some victims requiring a respirator to breathe. This would have been caused polio in past years. Like polio, AFM attacks the central nervous system, and so far no cure has been found. And it appears that nobody's too interested in finding the cause, because the cause might be vaccination. The CDC is blaming it on a strain of enterovirus that appears to be in circulation. And they're saying that everybody should get vaccinated, which might be exactly the wrong thing to do. But of course, they don't actually have a vaccine for this enterovirus. So vaccination couldn't possibly save you from getting acute flaccid myelitis if it was indeed caused by a virus. And if it was caused by a vaccine, it would just increase your risk of getting AFM. The world basically declared victory over polio, but really all that they did was that they renamed it. It's called AFP, acute flaccid paralysis, in third world countries. It's acute flaccid myelitis in the United States. But there are still young children being paralyzed, and nobody seems to know why. And it may not be entirely vaccines. There's strong evidence that in the post-war polio epidemic in the early 1950s, it could have been widespread use of DDT and similar organochlorine chemicals that only came into civilian use after World War II. They could have been the cause in those cases. Prior to World War II, obviously, those pesticides didn't exist. Couldn't have been the cause, but arsenic was the main component of pesticides prior to its displacement by organochlorines, organophosphates, and other organic chemicals post-World War II. In South Africa, as reported by SaneVax, in August of 2015, a woman who they call Sarah, I presume she wants to stay anonymous, sent some questions about HPV vaccine to CANSA, the Cancer Association of South Africa. She said, "Why is CANSA supporting the use of HPV vaccines when they are now proven to be deadly to some people? Several hundred young women have died because of this vaccine, and thousands more are permanently disabled or battling chronic health problems. The vaccine has never been proven to prevent cervical cancer." This was actually admitted even by the Nobel Prize Committee in 2008 when they gave the award to Zurhausen. "Many countries have banned these vaccines because they're not just useless but dangerous. Why is South Africa using them, and why does your webpage not list the potential side effects?" She received a response that basically said, "Trials have proved the efficacy of the vaccine in preventing cervical epithelial neoplasia, which is not cancer, is what's called precancerous lesions. The HPV vaccine prevents infection with certain species of HPVs associated with the development of cervical cancer." It doesn't point out that a lot of women can clear these on their own. "The cost effectiveness has been calculated. HPV infection is essential and necessary, although not sufficient cause of cervical cancer." So they're basically claiming it's necessary to produce cancer, but it's not sufficient. It's kind of a weak claim. What else is needed, and how do you know that those things alone can't cause cancer? So because Sarah didn't get any responses to her specific questions, she asked them again. "Why is CANSA supporting the use of the HPV vaccines when these are now proven to be deadly and when they have never been proven to prevent cervical cancer? Both India and Japan have stopped giving this vaccine because of the severe side effects." And eventually, I guess the CANSA got a little tired of this debate, and they very tersely responded, "Please forward to us any scientific evidence, unbiased peer-reviewed research, or scientific references that support and prove that A, HPV vaccines are deadly. B, that several hundred women have died as a direct result of the vaccine. C, that the HPV vaccine was directly responsible for the disability or disabilities that are claimed to result from HPV vaccine. And lastly, that there is a direct link between HPV vaccine and the chronic health problems you refer to. And of course, it's impossible to say in a particular situation, if somebody is vaccinated today and drops dead tomorrow, it's impossible to say with 100% certainty that the vaccine caused the death. It's possible that person would have dropped dead anyway. And so they were basically asking for things which were impossible to provide, and then they just clammed up and wouldn't send anything more. But it is telling that on their website, they would not even give the information on the side effects of the HPV vaccine. And you would think that if there have been young women, mostly young women vaccinated with HPV, who have died or have become seriously disabled after the vaccine, that people would have been warned, and it would be fine to say, we don't know for sure that there's a direct connection, but what they used to call the precautionary principle is, if there's some evidence that there's a connection, we should be careful. And certainly, mothers and their children should have the right to refuse the vaccine because of the large number of concerns that have been associated with the use of the HPV vaccine. And now let's go to Zika virus. In Miami Beach, they want to spray the pesticide Nalid. But Nalid is described in an article in The Guardian as a potent neurotoxin that kills mosquitoes on contact, which opponents claim can cause birth defects. Well, isn't this remarkable, because the Zika virus is supposed to cause the birth defects, microcephaly. And Nalid has been blamed for the deaths of millions of honeybees following aerial spraying in South Carolina, and therefore there are protests in Miami. I'm glad to see this. Natural News, which tends to be on the very far right of the political spectrum, criticizes House Republicans. The House of Representatives voted to loosen already weak pesticide regulations in a purported effort to combat the spread of the Zika virus. The latest version of the bill is called the Zika Control Act. Opponents of the legislation say it's being pushed for other reasons. Democrats, who largely voted against it, have accused the GOP of passing the bill deceptively, saying it's already been considered and rejected five times under four different guises, according to the newsletter The Hill. Again, if Zika virus is not the cause of the problems found in Brazil, and pesticides are the cause, then spraying pesticides to get rid of mosquitoes is a double danger. A virologist who studied at Oxford and elsewhere wrote, the evidence that Zika is unlikely to be linked to microcephaly. Tests for Zika are often confused by cross-reactions with other flaviviruses. Previous Zika epidemics in other places have not noted the link with microcephaly despite detailed follow-up. Why only microcephaly? Other viruses result in a range of birth defects. Why would Zika only be causing microcephaly? It would also be necessary to prove a specific tropism for the brain cells. That means that the virus is specifically attracted to brain cells. He says no such tropism or attraction has been shown in adult Zika infections. So that's evidence against Zika virus. The Philadelphia Inquirer commented on two members of Congress who extremely exaggerated what they said about the Zika virus. They note that Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, not a member of Congress, a senator, sorry. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand claimed over 4,000 babies in Brazil have been born in the last year with microcephaly. The newspaper points out that of those 4,180 suspected cases, only 270 were confirmed. The remaining were either under investigation or discarded. Senator Richard Blumenthal said those 4,000 cases have been linked to the outbreak of the Zika virus. However, as of January 29, 2016, only 6 of the 270 confirmed babies with microcephaly had tested positive for Zika. And what is microcephaly? Anyway, the problem with words is they make it seem like something is very, that there's a great deal of confidence in something when there actually isn't. A 2009 paper in Neurology says, microcephaly is an important neurological sign, but there is non-uniformity in its definition and evaluation. It can result from any insult that disturbs early brain growth, and it can be seen in association with hundreds of genetic syndromes. They don't mention the possibility that it could be associated with exposure to chemicals such as pesticides or vaccines. Annually, approximately 25,000 infants in the United States will be diagnosed with microcephaly, the head circumference less than 2 standard deviations from the average. Few data are available to inform evidence-based recommendations regarding diagnostic testing. Now, there's a problem with using statistics in this kind of area, because if you had a population in which there was nobody who had brain damage, there was nobody who had a small head, no baby had a small head due to any problem, genetic, chemicals, vaccines, or whatever, there would still be heads that were less than 2 standard deviations away from the mean. That's just a reality. There's always a certain percentage of anything that's less than 2 standard deviations from the mean. I think 5%, approximately 5% is 2 standard deviations. So you will always have babies in this, despite whether or not you have microcephaly. On the other hand, if the amount of microcephaly in the population was increasing, using a definition based on standard deviation would miss a lot of babies that actually did have microcephaly. So it's a terrible way to measure something like microcephaly if the rate differs from year to year. So if you're only concerned about genes, maybe it would be relatively static from year to year, but if it's caused by chemicals, it could vary widely. Even in places where pesticides are used fairly consistently, the environmental conditions change and the pesticides change. Some years they may start using more toxic pesticides. There may be more or less wind, more or less rain, temperatures may be higher or lower, and the effect of the pesticides under those conditions may be significantly different. And so they're recommending neuroimaging in order to identify structural problems with the baby's head, which is probably going to be necessary. But what this means is that it, as was seen in Brazil, you can measure the heads of infants to find a whole bunch of infants with microcephaly, and many of them have no problem. They're just really small. They're just slightly small babies. And there could also be babies who have problems that are missed. But without a consistent and meaningful definition of microcephaly, it's meaningless to talk about an epidemic of microcephaly. And of course, this was seen in Brazil, where the majority of cases that were thought to be microcephaly have not yet panned out. Here's an article about an out-of-control justice system and medical system. I found this in The Register, which is an article on information technology with the catch line, "Biting the Hand That Feeds IT," and their mascot is the vulture. So why does an IT magazine have an article on justice in the medical system? Well, a homeless IT consultant will learn today whether his challenge to a draconian order, which forces him to tell police in advance if he's going to have sex, will succeed. He has to give them 24 hours in advance, even if he only plans on kissing or engaging in a sexually explicit conversation. But he's never been convicted of a criminal offense. He cannot use any device that can connect to the internet, which police cannot later check. He has to give them the PIN for his home. He must physically hand over for inspection any electronic device he uses, and he's also banned from using or owning forensic wiping software, anything that could erase disks. This all occurred after he was cleared of rape following a retrial in which it was said that the verdict of the jury was unanimous. But during this trial, he talked to a doctor about his sadomasochistic fantasies. The doctor concluded from that he was a dangerous man and would sexually abuse any of his partners. John O'Neill claims that the doctor misunderstood what he was saying, and it appears that she contacted police and described his fantasies as a confession. So this was in August, and on August 19th they had a hearing, and the order stood, but now the order has lifted. The situation while he had the order was because he could not work, because he was cut off from any benefits, he was actually living in a campsite on the edge of the city of York in London, because he couldn't live anywhere, he couldn't work anywhere, he had no money. Anyway, in September 22nd, a judge ruled that the sexual risk order, there's a term in England, an SRO, was disproportionate. So the terms were reduced slightly. He now has to inform police as soon as reasonably practical if he plans to begin a sexual relationship with a woman. However, the judge still described him as dangerous. And maybe he is a dangerous person, but I think my conception of the justice system is that the justice system has to prove that you're dangerous and can't lose in court, take you to court on allegations of rape or whatever, but lose, and then basically slap you with essentially a prison sentence. Because if you can't work, if it's very difficult for you to have a relationship, it's pretty hard to rebuild your life after something like this. He might even be better off in jail than out under the circumstances. It's this collision between the medical system and the justice system. The justice system, having watched too much CSI, I guess, sees medical pronouncements as 100% certain. So if a nurse says this is a dangerous man based on the fantasies that he was probably encouraged to reveal to her, if the nurse says that these are real and these are what he would actually do with a girlfriend, the justice system takes it as a fact, and then they impose sanctions based on this fact that is being created by the medical system, as opposed to actually being able to prove their case in court. Anyway, I hope you found my ramblings of today interesting. Thank you for listening to episode 119 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Or now you can phone Zeno Live at 701-719-0990. Thank you for listening, and until next week, goodbye.